Hello, fellow travelers, and welcome to Adventures on Security. This is Session 2 for November 27th, 2005. I'm your host, Tom Olczak. This is a weekly podcast published each Sunday evening, sometime before midnight. You can also find most of the information covered in our sessions at adventuresinsecurity.com. If you're interested in commenting on what you hear or about topics you'd like us to talk about, please send an email to tom@adventuresinsecurity.com. The purpose of these podcasts is the exploration of security management, including the crazy things people try to do to each other and to themselves. This is the second session in a series of three in which we take a look at end-user device security. Before we get started in today's conversation about the final layers of a layered security model, I'd like to take a moment and review some of the things we talked about in session one. First of all, we talked about the importance of management support. If management, and I'm talking about security management right down through all the ranks of management, doesn't support, visibly support, the security policies and the importance of information security, employees are not going to consider the security policies, standards, and guidelines that are that make up the security program as important enough for them to pay any attention to. Which brings us to the next topic that we covered last week, which is the security program. A good solid security program, which again consists of policies, processes, guidelines, and standards, is absolutely essential to ensuring the safety of your information assets. And again, related to that and related to management support is user awareness. Just the presence of a security program is not enough. The users need to be made aware of it. They need to have clear processes to follow. They need to have been trained in the standards and guidelines that they're supposed to implement. And they need to understand the consequences of not conforming to the policies that are outlined in the security program. This week, we're going to talk about the remaining layers that can all be consolidated into access controls and configuration management. Next week in session three, we'll cover wireless handheld device security. And at that time, we'll go into more detail on wireless security. So let's take a look at access controls. There are three basic types of access controls: physical, administrative, and logical. Logical controls are often called technical controls. The purpose of physical access controls is to delay an intruder by employing several layers of barriers. The delay should be sufficient enough so that an incident response team, whether it's law enforcement, whether it's organizational security guards, can respond and detain the intruder. There are many different facets of physical security. I think for the purpose of this session, what we're going to do is we're going to focus on some of the more common things that managers have to deal with. The first of these is the security of laptops. Laptops, even in the office, need to be secured. If they're not being used, if they're not in an area where someone can keep an eye on them, if it's after hours, laptops need to be locked in a secure place. Many organizations like to apply patches and perform other upgrades at night, and they like to have their users keep their systems on for that purpose. Laptop users should be an exception to this process. The other thing that the laptop users should be aware of is that they should always keep physical control of their laptops when they're not in the office. For example, when flying to business meetings, the laptop should be carried on to the plane as carried on luggage, not checked with luggage that's going to be going through the baggage handling system. Another area of concern is the use of laptops in public areas. It's important that each of your employees understands that sensitive information displayed on a screen in a public area is subject to being shoulder surfed. In other words, subject to being viewed by someone who really doesn't have the right or the need to know for that information. This is particularly important when dealing with information that's regulated under HIPAA or information that can result in identity theft. But it isn't just laptops that can become a vulnerability for your organization. Workstations also have their their share of problems. One of the ways that you can provide physical security for your workstations is to restrict access to floors where there are workstations that either contain or process sensitive or confidential information. Another thing you might want to consider is restricting the ability for non-employees or employees without a need to know to view information that on workstation displays. This is especially important for workstations that are in public areas. In medical facilities, for example, nursing stations have shared devices, and the devices may be positioned incorrectly so that individuals who are not members of a patient's immediate family may be able to view information about that patient. Also, if you can't place shared devices behind a locked door, at least place them in a public area or in a publicly viewable area so that it's easy to see if an unauthorized person attempts to use one or more of the systems. Now let's talk about a couple things that are common to both laptops and workstations. One of the most common problems is users saving data on local storage. Local storage that is not saved in centralized disk storage devices or on servers is out of management's control. And one of the most important problems is that it's not normally backed up on a regular basis. One of the ways to ensure that your users are properly protecting their workstations is through administrative controls. These controls consist primarily of management policies and procedures designed to protect information against unwanted employee behavior. The use of systems for personal reasons and the use of systems for illegal or unethical reasons are covered under administrative policies. One of the ways you can ensure that you have the right employees in your organization and that they are aware of all of your policies and safeguards for protecting your information assets is to implement good, solid hiring processes and policies. And augment those with good orientation and termination processes. Your orientation processes should include an introduction to your security program, that it exists, where to find it, who to ask if an employee has questions. Termination processes, of course, should include processes for both dealing with individuals who are leaving under less than honorable conditions, as well as employees who are leaving on their own accord. But even good employees, employees who conscientiously adhere to all of your policies, are still going to be lured into going to places that are going to put the network at risk. So a couple things that you can do is to employ web access controls and anti-malware defenses. Web access controls will prevent users from going to places or to websites that are known to be the distributors of spyware, viruses, worms, and anti-malware defense will ensure that your users who are going out to use their internet mail or in some other way unintentionally bring malware into your organization do not spread it throughout the rest of your network. So now that we've covered administrative and physical controls, we're going to talk about logical controls, which are a set of controls that most managers are aware of. These are controls that you use every day when you log into your network or log into your workstation. They prevent access into local machines, or they prevent access to your network. Now, the recommended access control method is role-based. In role-based access control, users have no access to resources that they don't absolutely need for the execution of their day-to-day tasks. Role-based access control is something that you use every day and you may not even know it. When you log into your workstation or you log into the network, you are going to be given access to resources based on groups that you belong to or based on other criteria that is set up by your network administrators. And prior to allowing you access to any of those resources, most organizations are going to go through some type of identity management process. Now, identity management is just the process of identifying a person positively, making sure that the person who's standing in front of a keyboard or trying to use a laptop is exactly who they say they are. Some of the ways that this can be done is with biometrics. Biometrics can use fingerprints, finger architecture, hand architecture, voice recognition, or other ways to uniquely identify someone through who they are. Yeah, another way to do it is to use things like proximity sensors. A user can actually carry something. It's something that they have. And a proximity sensor really is a good method of implementing identity management for shared workstations. As a user walks up to the workstation, they can be automatically logged in. When they walk away, they can be automatically logged out. In addition to biometrics and proximity sensors, things like tokens, smart cards can be put into a smart card reader, and maybe a PIN goes along with that to uniquely identify that, yes, this person who knows a password or a PIN and also has the right fingerprint, has the right token, is trying to log into the network. And finally, for laptops, another logical control would be disk encryption. If a laptop is stolen, it's not that difficult to break a password and get into the system and start browsing around files. Due diligence dictates that laptops that contain confidential or sensitive information have their drives encrypted. And the important part here, the important thing to understand here, is that your security team or someone else in your IS department needs to have the passwords or keys or certificates to get into those drives if an employee leaves suddenly and you need access to important information. Another logical control deals with protecting remote access. Users that travel a lot, use laptops from home, hotel rooms, etc., need some way to connect to your network. And when doing so, make sure that the data traveling, and it's usually traveling over the internet, is secure. The typical way of doing this is the implementation of a virtual private network. A virtual private network uses encryption, and it encrypts your data as it travels from the workstation or laptop to your network or to a server on your network. Then it can be done in one of two ways. It can be done with Internet Protocol Security, or IPsec, or it can be done with SSL technology. If you don't have a large IT staff and you don't want to get involved in creating virtual private networks for your employees, there's a couple things you can do. One, there are services available on the internet, and we'll talk about those during later sessions, that can provide you, at a very reasonable cost, VPN services. Or you can just use dial-up, maybe directly into your network. If the amount of data that you're transferring back and forth is minimal, or if you're on a small budget, dial-up is still a viable way to get your remote users connected to your network. The last logical control we're going to talk about is intrusion defense. Intrusion defense is the process of not only trying to keep malware and attackers out of your network, but it's also involved with dealing with those attackers and that malware if it does penetrate your perimeter. As we discussed in session one, infected workstations, infected end-user devices infect networks. So we need to make sure that we pay attention to our end-user devices, not just our servers, to ensure that if a device is infected, that we stop it right there, or we stop it on the subnet where that device is located. So we can do this in a number of ways. The first thing we do is we try very hard to prevent anything from getting onto a workstation. We do this with antivirus and anti-spyware software. Antivirus software is usually put right on the workstation or right on a server. It's also common to put it on your email servers. Email servers are a big portal that attackers and malware use to get into your network. anti-spyware software is in its infancy. Spyware is extremely hard to detect. You don't want it in your network. You don't want it on a workstation. So I would recommend that you stop it at the perimeter. And most of the anti-spyware software that's coming out or is available today does exactly that. You put an appliance on your perimeter, and it will help to filter out spyware based on signatures, based on things that are known about the behavior of spyware. Gets that stuff at the perimeter before it has a chance to get in and embed itself. And like I said, it's extremely difficult to detect before it can embed itself in one or more of your network devices. Another control commonly employed by organizations is personal firewalls. Many organizations do not like to put firewalls on their workstations. It has a tendency to interfere with a lot of applications. However, it is probably the single most important thing you can do to not just to keep things from getting into your workstation that shouldn't be there, but more importantly, it stops your workstations from pushing things out into your network that really you don't want there and spreading all over your enterprise. Personal firewalls, not very expensive, are being shipped with most antivirus suites. It's a good idea to make sure that you take a look, and you don't have to lock them down completely. Do what's reasonable and appropriate for your organization. But even if you're only 80% protected, it's better than having the absence of any kind of firewall between an infected workstation and your business critical applications. Another emerging technology is host-based intrusion prevention software. Intrusion prevention software is very much like identity or intrusion detection software, except that it does prevent certain activities from happening on a workstation. For example, it can prevent the copying of files to or from specific folders. It can prevent the deleting of files from specific folders. It can identify suspect behavior, and it looks both internally as well as externally. So the result is that if something is trying to execute on a workstation that then is attempting to spread itself across your network or to go out and explore your network, like with ping sweeps, and a host-based IPS system can stop that from occurring. So most mainstream security companies are converging antivirus, anti-spyware, firewalls, and host-based intrusion prevention systems into a suite of products. So when you need to go out and you're looking to build a new baseline image for your workstations, I would recommend that you take a look at these suites and come up with something that, again, is reasonable appropriate for your budget and reasonable appropriate for your network. The final thing we're going to talk about in this session is configuration management. Now, I include patch management in configuration management as a subset. So as we go through configuration management, we will address the issues of patching. An effective configuration management program is a key element in the protection of devices connected to your network. Attacks against your network are opportunistic. In other words, attackers are looking for soft targets. The compromise of which requires the lowest possible work factor. A work factor is a level of effort it takes to break through your defenses. Properly configuring your applications, databases, and operating systems can increase the work factor so much that an attacker moves on to a softer target. Risks associated with poor configuration management are very common among organizations. Poor or non-existent configuration management practices result in network components that are easy targets. And in this session, I'm going to identify five security risks based on poor configuration management. The first is that known security flaws in operating systems, applications, and databases are not patched. Potential attackers know about these vulnerabilities as soon as they're announced. In fact, it's the attackers in many cases who have identified these vulnerabilities. Failure to apply vendor-supplied patches to correct these flaws is an invitation to attackers looking for company networks where the vulnerabilities exist. Unnecessary services running on workstations or servers is another security risk. For example, a workstation certainly doesn't need to have web services running on it unless you have some very special need. And in addition to that, it's also something you should also determine whether or not the server service or for users to remotely access a workstation is actually necessary in your environment. Error messages that provide too much information is our third security risk. With the right tools, an attacker can intentionally cause an error on a network device. If the device is running with a default configuration, it might provide information about the operating system and system patch levels, among other things. The fourth security risk involves weak default passwords assigned to applications or system services. Accounts are sometimes created as part of the installation process for an application or operating system. Often, the default password is easy to guess or doesn't exist at all. Old production files or sample files left on server or workstation drives is our fifth and final security risk. Unused applications or demo software may leave behind scripts, applications, data files, configuration files, or web pages that may be easily exploited. You may not even be aware of their presence. The purpose of configuration management is to effectively address these and other configuration issues in an effort to mitigate or remove vulnerabilities inherent in installed systems. Building a configuration management program to address the last layers of the security model consists of several steps, and these include assigning responsibility for managing and overseeing configuration management activities to a specific team or individual, creating secure system configuration standards and guidelines, and creating and maintaining an ongoing configuration management process. Now let's take a look at each of these steps in more detail. Without assigning responsibility for creating and maintaining strong configuration management processes, your systems will most likely remain vulnerable to attack. Network engineers and software developers are usually very busy. Worrying about patches, unneeded services, and weak default passwords tend to fall low on the list of priorities. So who should be held accountable for proper device configuration? In larger organizations, this responsibility often lies in information security. Information security defines policies, standards, guidelines, and security baselines for enterprise systems, which are then used by engineering and development teams to design and implement business solutions. Information security provides oversight by periodically testing installed systems for compliance. In organizations without a dedicated information security team, I recommend assigning these tasks to the person or team responsible for managing the network. This separates vulnerability management from the person or team focused on implementing the organization's technology and puts it into the hands of those individuals who perform day-to-day operational tasks. Day-to-day activities should be expanded to include not only definition of standards and guidelines, but also oversight activities to ensure compliance. Regardless of who is responsible, all members of your technical staff must work together to identify and remediate system weaknesses. The next step is to create secure standards and guidelines. We examined the importance of policy, standards, and guidelines in the previous session. In this session, we'll focus specifically on configuration management standards and guidelines. Probably the most important task in configuration management is the creation of a security baseline configuration. This baseline configuration should be generic enough to allow its deployment on all workstations, regardless of their use. In many organizations, multiple baselines may be necessary. Applying the baseline to a workstation should accomplish the following. First, all services not required for general operation of the device should be disabled. Second, all default accounts are disabled or controlled, and strong passwords are applied. Third, logging and alerting is enabled for failed logins, successful logins, and changes to security. And fourth, all critical security patches are applied. Once the baseline configurations are created and tested, special purpose configurations should be created to enable secure operation of specific types of systems. The application of a type-specific configuration should result in necessary services that might have been disabled with the baseline configuration turned back on, critical security patches applied to the applications running on the system, and all default application accounts using controlled strong passwords. Upon completion of successful testing of the type-specific configurations, you're ready to deploy securely configured systems into your environment. Deployment consists of six steps. First, build a workstation using standard system build documentation. Apply your secure baseline configuration as the second step. Third, confirm proper configuration and operation of the system. Fourth, apply your type-specific configuration if necessary. Fifth, confirm proper configuration and operation of the system. And sixth, move to production. The next step is to create and maintain an ongoing configuration management process. It isn't enough to simply apply secure configurations and assume your network devices will remain secure. Configuration management is a continuous process that includes the creation and maintenance of a system inventory. It's impossible to develop an ongoing configuration management program unless you know at a minimum the operating systems and applications with associated patch levels that are running on your network. Next, you have to monitor for the latest announced vulnerabilities related to the items in your inventory. The National Vulnerability Database, located at nvd.nist.gov, that's nvd.nist.gov, and vendor sites are good sources for this information. The next step in configuration management is the prioritization of vulnerability remediation tasks. Not all vulnerabilities for which patches exist should be immediately patched. Managing the application of patches is a risk-based activity. A simple application of the risk management principles can help determine where to apply your resources to maximize your vulnerability mitigation efforts. Testing of all configuration changes comes next. Change management is a critical process in any configuration management program. Failure to properly test a change and to assess the risks associated with that change might result in the same or greater negative business impact you might experience from an attack. Next, update baseline configuration standards and guidelines. Threats and vulnerabilities change over time. It's important to maintain a set of system configurations and processes that work to defend against the changing nature of system risks. Finally, perform continuous vulnerability scanning. There's always some drift from the optimum computing environment as defined in your security program. Vulnerability scanning for both internal systems and your perimeter can help identify deviations from stated policy. This prevents a false sense of security based on incorrect assumptions about the level of hardware and software compliance with security standards and guidelines. It also provides a means to determine how vulnerable your systems are to newly announced vulnerabilities. So we've stepped through a pretty comprehensive approach to configuration management, and it seems like that's, you know, pretty easy to implement. However, there are challenges to effective configuration management. It isn't always easy to convince company management to commit resources to configuration management activities. Let's face it, there's no immediate positive impact on your company's bottom line. Other obstacles to effective configuration management include a lack of standard system configurations for workstations and other end-user devices. The greater the number of differences among your systems, the lower the probability that you'll be able to cost-effectively manage system configurations. Testing for every possible combination of workstation image present on your network might require a resource commitment large enough to convince management to simply accept a large number of vulnerabilities. Finally, poor software quality or poor vendor response when vulnerabilities are discovered can hinder your efforts at good configuration management. When purchasing new solutions for your business, research the overall quality of each component, including your research, the level of customer satisfaction with the component vendor's response to discovered security problems in their products. What is the average time between vulnerability discovery and patch release? The proper application of risk management principles can help justify the additional effort required to select the right solutions and to manage inherent vulnerabilities over time. Well, that's it for this week. Next week, we're going to cover wireless handheld devices, and that'll wrap up our three-part series on end-user device security. I hope we were able to make your life a little easier. Until next time, be careful what you click.